it's a sad fact that very few of us know as much as we should about the Aboriginal inhabitants of this country. Certainly it wasn't something that seemed to be a priority at my school in my day. It seems to be a bit different now, thank goodness, but a lot of us have been left with a big gap when it comes to a knowledge of and an understanding of Aboriginal culture and history. Well, Professor Larissa Berendt intends to change all that. She's written the latest Dummies Guide, which is called Indigenous Australia for Dummies. It's a comprehensive book which addresses some of the myths and misconceptions that get trotted out regularly in regard to the original inhabitants of this country. But the book does much more than that, and we're good enough to be joined this morning by Professor Larissa Berendt. And, she's with us now. Good morning, Professor. Oh, we seem to have lost her. Let me tell you a little bit about Larissa. She's apart from being the author of this book, she's also a barrister and director of research at the Jumbunna Indigenous House of Learning at the University of Technology in Sydney, and she's also the first Aboriginal Australian to graduate from the Harvard Law School. So she knows what she's talking about. She's on a number of boards and got a number of duties looking after Indigenous organisations around the country. So we're very happy to have her on board with us this morning. Larissa, are you there?
I sure am.
Hi, look, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Michael.
No worries. Very big job putting together a comprehensive dummies guide to Indigenous Australia. There are plenty of dummies out there like me who need to get up to scratch exactly with some of the history of the Indigenous people of this country, and it must have been a big job for you.
Well, it was a big job. I guess it took me about a year and a half to do the research. And there were some areas, of course, you know, my background is in some of these areas, but not all of them. So there were some areas that I thought would be a little bit more easy for me to cover, and there were others, I have to confess, like sport, that I had to do a little bit more research on. I did find that, of course, this guide's for people who sort of feel like they don't know anything and need a place to start, that along the way I actually learned a lot of things that I didn't know about Aboriginal Australia, and I'm an expert, apparently, so it certainly was a lot of fun doing the research for it.
Now, we'll start off because there are a number of misconceptions and myths about Aboriginal people, and I'll get you to address a few of those because one of the chapters in the book specifically looks at just that thing. And one of those is that Aboriginal communities, Aboriginal people get slighted with the fact that they're prone to alcoholism. And it's just a total inaccuracy.
Yeah, it's an interesting statistic around the drinking. And, of course, the perception a lot of people have is that that most Aboriginal people would have some kind of issue with alcohol. In fact, the statistics show that as a total population, Aboriginal people actually, there are less Aboriginal people in the Aboriginal population who drink. Now, within the population, there are Aboriginal people who drink much more than the average, but actually as a total thing, you'll find more people in the Aboriginal community who do not drink at all. So it seems to be that that's one misconception, partly because in some communities we do have some very serious problems with alcohol that need addressing and have been very difficult to address, and that seems to have skewed people's views. But when you look at the continued population data that's taken, the surveys like the ABS and things like that, it consistently shows that a lot of Aboriginal people don't drink at all.
Now, the other one is that the Indigenous people are a dying race, which a lot of people seem to trot out from time to time. And that's a total inaccuracy as well.
Yes, actually, it's been for many years. And, of course, that was true in 1901 when Australia became a federation, and a couple of our laws were in the Constitution were kind of prefaced on the assumption that we'd be kind of extinct by the 1930s at the rate that the population had been dropping at that time. But especially since the 1960s, it's started to, the population level started to consolidate, and it's actually increasing. And the last few censuses that have been done, pretty much from the 1970s onward, started to show a slight increase in the population, and now it continues to increase. We've just had recent ABS numbers come out, and the population is increasing. There are a couple of factors that explain that. One is that it's true to say now that a lot more people who have Aboriginal ancestry are identifying as Aboriginal, whereas, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, there were a lot of extra regulations around the Aboriginal community that made it less attractive to do so. And now I think, as you mentioned before, there's a little bit more recognition and a bit more pride around Aboriginal issues, so that there are more people who are just, you know, interested in that ancestry and genuinely identify with it. But also, we have a very young population. If you compare the Aboriginal population to the overall Australian population, we have a much younger demographic, and Aboriginal people are having slightly more children than other Australians. So our population continues to grow there, with a demographic that's got a much younger profile to it than the Australian population, which is often described as generally an ageing population. So that's an interesting dynamic that keeps coming up as a result of the census. So I think, given that that's been a trend over a couple of decades now, it's true to say that it's actually a growing population.
Which is quite remarkable, really. If we look at the numbers, so we get down to, like, I think the first data you've got in here goes back to 1901, was it? And the population was down to quite low numbers then. When it started, when the first Europeans came to Australia, how big was the Indigenous population then?
Well, that's an issue that has a lot of speculation around it. So the numbers vary greatly because, of course, we don't know. So there are different ways that different anthropologists or historians have calculated it. But the 1788, the population estimates have been everywhere between, on the very conservative side, of 250,000, which would take it up to a little less than what it is today, and then up to over a million people, which seems to be one of the also more often quoted estimates, is around a million people. So it's a vast continent that's now, you know, obviously supporting a population much larger than that, but they seem to indicate some enormous numbers. But, you know, with those first statistics that are in there of 1901, that's probably the first attempt to do it. And look, there is an issue around the statistics with population, and that is that even the Australian Bureau of Statistics, the ABS, admits that it's quite difficult to get accurate data on Aboriginal populations because they have to make extra special efforts to get the data properly. You know, they've found over the years, for a range of reasons, from the remoteness of some Aboriginal communities to the level of literacy in the Aboriginal community to a suspicion of governments, that it's often been difficult to engage people in the census, Aboriginal people in the census process. But even so, that those population figures way back in 1788 would be over 100 years from when we did those first surveys, which, as I said, would probably not be 100% accurate, but would give you some idea. So one of the huge impacts, of course, on that decrease in population, along with the you know, the impact of colonisation, was the impact of European diseases on an Aboriginal community. And of course now, over all these generations, there's been immunity to a lot of those diseases that have built up that Aboriginal people didn't have when there was first contact.
Yeah, all right. And, you know, not helped, of course, by the fact that Aboriginal people weren't actually counted on the census until the late 60s.
No, that's right. So the data is very, very difficult to find reliable. But even today, you know, it's in terms of trying to bed down statistics for this book, you have to look at the ABS census that the general population does. But they go out and do a particular breakdown and an additional census of Aboriginal communities to kind of cross-check their data and get a specific profile, because there is still problems with getting them being completely confident that they've got an accurate number in there.
But your figure in the book is 500,000 or thereabouts?
Yeah, I think that would surprise many people, especially because, you know, we had the opening of Bangarra here in Sydney last night, the Aboriginal Dance Company. I was actually talking to somebody about the fact that we still meet people who say, oh, you're the first Aboriginal people I've met, or I've never met an Aboriginal person. And even today, you know, obviously there's still people who don't have that contact with Aboriginal people. So I think a lot of these issues come as a bit of a surprise. And that was kind of the idea of writing the book, was, you know, find a little place where you can try and answer some of those questions that you'd really like to ask.
Which actually brings me to the next thing I was going to ask, the next myth, in fact, that you mentioned in the book, which is a lot of people think that the Aboriginal communities are pretty much relegated to Northern Territory and the outback and stuff, but a great proportion of Aboriginal people actually live in urban settings.
That's right, and the largest Aboriginal population in terms of of an actual community, in terms of how a census might pick them up, is actually Western Sydney, and the largest population is in New South Wales, with the second largest being in Queensland. So, and for a long time, about a third of the Aboriginal population has lived in cities. So it's an important thing, not just because it kind of busts the myth that every Aboriginal people live in remote or rural areas and that's kind of the general profile. The ABS statistics show that some of those communities, and I'm particularly thinking of Western Sydney, do tend to be to come up on census data as having a much lower socioeconomic profile than other communities in say some rural and remote areas. So there is a fair bit of disadvantage in some of those urban populations as well. So it means there needs to be kind of a specific thought given to thinking about issues like education and health, those sort of central issues that the population needs to concentrate on because they're behind the national averages. But there needs to be a different approach for communities in rural areas and remote areas to what there is in urban areas. But those urban populations tend to be a little bit overlooked because a lot of service delivery and, you know, concentration on the effort of closing the gap goes into rural and remote areas.
Yeah, and look, one more myth that we'll bring up is about the Tasmanian Aborigines, who, we often get heard that they've been wiped out entirely, but that's not true as well, because there is there's a big population in Tasmania of people with an Indigenous connection.
Yes, and they have a very, very strong cultural community down there and still engage in a lot of cultural activities, particularly the mutton birding, and, yep. Have a very strong Aboriginal community. It's true, still travel around Australia and occasionally I'll meet people who'll talk about it. And particularly overseas, that's a real myth about Australia still. I think there's probably some a bit more recognition now in across the Australian community that Aboriginal people didn't get completely wiped out in Tasmania. But certainly overseas, that's a big myth that continues, that they were completely wiped out.
It's a remarkable story of survival when you think about it, Larissa. Well, that's what occurred to me when I was reading through the book, and just to see the amount of things, the amount of discrimination that Aboriginal people have had to put up with, the basic being up against the wall with the things like the diseases early on in the piece, to rebound and to have a population of 500,000 and to have kept the culture intact in many ways, it really is a remarkable story of survival.
Yes, I'm really glad you saw it that way, because I think, sometimes it's easy to look at the issues around closing the gap, and especially when, we see dysfunctional communities on television and in the news, and it can feel like it's a little bit overwhelming and we spend a lot of effort on these issues, and we don't often get the good news stories of what's happening. And I really did feel as I went through the research for the book and putting the book together that there actually are some really great positive stories. And first of all, as you say, just about the survival and the rebounding of the population and the sustaining of the culture. So one thing I wanted to look at in the book was the way in which, say, for example, you spoke about the impact of diseases. And from the 1960s, the Aboriginal communities have developed very strong community health services, which have been the most effective agents for improving Aboriginal health. And now there's, even since I've been at university, a sort of new generation of Aboriginal doctors coming through. And in my father's generation, there was a whole generation of Aboriginal nurses that came through. So you sort of see not just the rebound in the figures, but when you dig into it, there are these great stories about how, you sort of see fantastic Australians like Fred Hollows, for example, making a huge impact with his work. But along the way, the Aboriginal communities themselves becoming the most effective agent for change. And there's a very positive story there. And you know, I think a lot of the Aboriginal people in sport become quite high profile, great role models. But it seemed to me along the way there were people in a whole range of areas, from health and education particularly, I guess for me, because I think they're two of our most critical issues, who were also role models. And I'm also heavily involved in the arts, and it seemed like there were some wonderful people. You just had Jimmy Little playing at the beginning of this segment, who, you know, obviously his music appeals to a wide range of Australians. And then again, you just mentioned Bengara, our dance company, that there are lots of really positive ways in which Aboriginal people have, you know, started to sing about their culture or write about their culture, and through Bengara keep, you know, Aboriginal dance practices going. There really is quite a vibrant Aboriginal culture, and you know, it's not just a myth that people think that all the Tasmanian Aborigines got killed off, when that actually didn't happen. But it's also sometimes a bit of a myth people have that Aboriginal culture is dead. So going through the book, it was really great to collate not just the survival of the people, but as you say, there's a real story of the survival of the culture as well.
Yeah, look, it is a very comprehensive book, and it'd be a handy one for anybody to have on their bookshelf as a reference book. Of course, in it you mentioned the Aboriginal sports people before, but the amount of contribution from not only the sports people but the political activists, as well as the musicians, as well as the storytellers, there really is a wonderful rich history. And some of the freedom fighters that are mentioned in the book, one in particular I want to bring up, by a fellow by the name of Pemulwuy, who was one of the early resistance fighters. And I mean, his story would be a remarkable movie. If someone, you know, if anyone ever made a movie and wanted to make a movie about a freedom fighter, this would be the fellow, because he, it's quite a remarkable story. He survived being shot several times, and he really was fighting. Initially, he had good contact with Governor Phillip, and along the way, there was a misunderstanding. I think he speared Governor Phillip, is that right? As a reprisal?
Yeah, he was involved with the incident, yeah.
And there was a big reward put out for him. Unfortunately, Pemulwuy lost his life, because they sent his head to London. It's never been returned. It's a bit of a tragic story. But the story that leads up to that, and how he led the Aboriginal resistance and took part in many battles, I suppose, with the authorities at the time. It's quite an incredible story, and the book is littered with stories like that.
Yes, and many years ago, I think now it was in the early 90s or late 1980s, there was a book done just on his life. But it is an extraordinary story, and one that actually a lot of Aboriginal people know, but probably a lot of the broader population of Australia doesn't know. And, there's often a bit of talk about Bennelong, and people know who Bennelong was because he had a tragic relationship with the first colony, but was also a figure who negotiated a lot between the Aboriginal people and the first colonists. And Pemulwuy's experience, as you just described, was quite different, and he became much more of a resistance fighter. I also find his story, you know, very, very interesting. It's, as you say, it's quite a tragic story. It's almost like the story of that period of conflict and colonisation. His experience encapsulates it. They thought, because as you mentioned, he'd been shot a couple of times and he survived, that he was perhaps, you know,
invincible. Yeah.
Which of course he wasn't, as it turned out to be.
I mean, they caught him and he was, after he was shot, and they put him in the infirmary and even managed to get out of there. He escaped several times from captivity.
In lots of ways he was able to outsmart him. And I thought it was an important story, not just because, as you say, in and of itself it's very interesting and it captures a particular moment in history, but, you know, there is still a myth that is certainly prevalent, at least, you know, 15 years ago, where it was sort of Aboriginal people were here and then you know, white society came and Aboriginal people kind of went into the mist. And there are a lot of stories around the country. I mean, pretty much everywhere anyone lives, there's an Aboriginal history of some kind of resistance in this way. And I thought his story kind of also encapsulated that style of resistance. It was very tenacious in that area because he was sort of there at that time before the colonies had completely spread over the mountains, and they were just sort of starting into that area.
And as the story goes, that he actually had quite a peaceful relationship with Governor Phillip at the start, but things turned nasty when some members of his family were, I think, mistreated by whites. Perhaps even one of his family was raped, I think, by some of the convicts or the settlers. And it got ugly from there. But an amazing story, and just one of the many stories in this book. We should take some calls. I actually got a question there about how many Aboriginal Australians are actually living outside of Australian boundaries. You got any idea about that?
Well, we don't, because there aren't census figures on it. So that would have to be a real guess as to how many Aboriginal people live overseas. I wouldn't like to hazard a guess, because I'm sure it would just be a guess.
All right. No worries. Let's have a chat to Stephen, see what he's got to say. Good morning, Stephen.
Oh, hello. How are you going?
Good, thank you.
Good. I'd like to ask your guest. I can't remember her name.
Larissa.
Larissa, hello.
Hi.
As a non-Indigenous person, I feel that very, very guiltily that I live on stolen land, and I'm a recipient of stolen goods. I would, as you mentioned before, that in the early days of the first settlers, Aboriginal people had contact and had dealings with the individual settlers, something like that. I feel that why can't we resurrect that concept and have treaties, the individual treaties? Don't worry about the government. The government's racist. They're never going to have a treaty with the Aboriginal people. I think we'll be waiting until doomsday for that. So why don't we...
Why don't we have a treaty?
You have a treaty, individual treaties, pay the rent for living on stolen land, things like that, you know.
Yeah. Good on you, Stephen.
What do you feel about that?
Yeah, Larissa, we will ask you about that. Firstly, though, I'll ask you about, before we get to the treaty thing, how did you feel about the apology? How did it go down with the community?
Well, I mean, I think the apology was a really important national moment. And I know it wasn't just that for the Aboriginal community. I think it was genuinely something that a lot of Australians felt was an important thing. And my personal cards on the table, I mean, if you ask me what kind of Australia I would like to see us work towards, it's one where all Australians see Aboriginal history and culture as part of their history and culture. So I think it meant a lot to Aboriginal people like me that other Australians felt that it was an important moment for them too, that we sort of share this history. And so I think it was certainly seen that my grandmother was a stolen generation person, and my father had been brought up in a home, and it took us many generations, two generations, to reunite our family. And you know, that's just one family story. We were all affected by the policy, and it's hard to find an Aboriginal family who wasn't at least in some way affected by it. So I think it was really important. Where I think there's started to be, and that support was unanimous at the time, just virtually unanimous. The speech was a lovely speech, and it hit all the right notes. I think where since then there's probably been, in my research, a little bit of dissonance, is that the apology was such an important symbolic moment, and it's an issue, I think, for some Aboriginal people. I've noticed as I've looked around the country that they don't feel that it's led to any significant policy changes, that on some of the areas around closing the gap, there hasn't been any movement. And I think just raises the interesting question of the need to balance the symbolic with the practical, I think.
Do you think we need a treaty?
Look, I think there's a very strong argument about making some kind of official compact between Aboriginal people and the Australian community in the form of something like a treaty. And other countries with a very similar history to ours, New Zealand, Canada and the United States, have had them. And in fact, Canada has, since the 1990s, had a modern treaty-making process. So they still keep their historic treaties where those were made, but there are parts of Canada where they weren't. And the federal government in the 1990s started to talk to those communities about that. And I think, you know, the issue that it deals with is the one about, you know, what is that residual relationship between Aboriginal people and the colonising nation. And that's a sort of, I guess, what people would say, a bit of unfinished business. But I would say that, you know, I've always been a strong advocate for a treaty, and the book does have some sections in it that talk about a treaty and why it's an issue that continues to come up for Aboriginal people, and certainly from the Aboriginal community's point of view, a recurring wish that there would be some sort of agreement like that. But I think that sort of change needs to come along with other changes. We talk about the need to, you know, change our constitution so that it protects against racially discriminatory laws. And, you know, we need to see more effective policies that around issues like economic development and education and health. Just mentioned them a few times on the show are my particular interests. So, you know, I think you need to also see it as just one step in a very holistic approach to dealing with a whole range of problems. The other issue that Steve mentioned, of course, was the interest in land. And one thing I've tried to canvass in the book is that Aboriginal people still feel a very strong attachment to their land. It's not just a spiritual attachment, but they sort of seem to understand and appreciate that once upon a time when this was Aboriginal land, it provided sustenance and sustainability for Aboriginal communities. And there's a very sophisticated view in the Aboriginal community now about the role that an interest in land can play in improving the economic fortunes of an Aboriginal community. So the interest in land becomes very strong, but I was interested that it's not just for the sake of returning the land, but because they see it as a way of, you know, being self-sufficient and being able to use it as a resource that will allow them to become independent.
I got a text here from Linda that said Pemulwuy was Australia's version of Geronimo.
Probably right.
A Band-Aid says the Torres Strait Islanders get a mention. Of course they do, Band-Aid. They're a big part of the picture and a big reference point in the book as well, aren't they, Larissa?
Yes, they are. I mean, if there's, you know, one thing about the term Indigenous is that it is used to designate both Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders, and it became a little bit too wordy to say Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander for dummies.
Yep.
So we've used the shorthand, but certainly throughout the book, in every chapter, I've referred to the story of the Torres Strait Islander people as well.
All right, let's have a chat to Richard this morning. Hi, Richard.
Oh, g'day. How are you going?
Good, thanks.
My question basically comes down to, and I mean, I'm European, but why do Aboriginal people feel so much animosity towards modern Australia when most crimes whatever happened to the Aborigines happened basically was through the English under English rule. I mean, why aren't they directing their anger towards the English and demanding apologies from the English? I mean, they are still there. There's a big island over the other side of the world, ruled by a queen. And these are the people that did a lot of these atrocities, or perceived atrocities, and yet I'm made to feel sorry and I'm made to feel bad about it, not even do anything to it. I mean, I'm as much a victim as ever. I mean, my parents were brought out here, or not my parents, my relatives and all that were brought out here in convict ships and things like that. I mean, well, we didn't want to come out here either, you know.
Do you hear this argument much, Larissa?
Look, we do a little bit, and there's a couple of things that Richard raises in that might be of interest. The first is that one thing that I found doing the research and also just through my work generally around Aboriginal legal issues and rights issues is that there's actually quite a strong section within the Aboriginal community, particularly amongst older Aboriginal people, who certainly do feel that the I guess they would particularly say the royal family or the Queen as somebody to focus on has a responsibility and owes a debt to Aboriginal people. And it's an interesting little stream of argument that comes up around the issues of the Republic, that there is actually an argument that emerges from parts of the Aboriginal community that says, look, we don't want to talk about becoming a republic until this unfinished business with the Queen is done. So there certainly is some connection back to, you know, to who had made those original declarations that Australia was now part of the British colony and the consequences for that for Aboriginal people.
I was going to say, because the English actually were quite forward in making new laws to protect the Aboriginal people from the other side of the world as well, should be said.
Yes, and it was actually, they had a lot of trouble in implementing them in the colonies, and the distance became a real difficulty, and it's very hard when you're the colonial government in England to control what's happening on the frontier. And those issues you raised around Pemulwuy's experience were probably a good example, and went quite contrary to the way in which the English had said that they thought that colonial laws should be administered in the colony. The colonists sort of had the view that they were a very long way away and didn't understand the issues properly. The other thing I'd say, though, is that, you know, my personal view is that I don't think it's helpful to make people feel guilty about that history. It's a shared history, and good things happened and bad things happened. And all along the way, and I hope that you can see this in the book, there's been lots of examples of where the Aboriginal community and the broader Australian community have worked together on a whole range of issues. And the tone of the book is deliberately meant to be one that's much more engaging and informative than one that takes a position that, I don't shy away from the things that have happened, and I certainly don't think we should. I think we need to acknowledge them. But making people feel a personal guilt about that history, I think, takes us a long way from being able to feel like it's a shared history.
Well, I'll just read this quote quickly. This comes from Captain Cook, Captain James Cook, in May 1771. Said, and this is the Aboriginal people he observed, "These people may truly be said to be in a pure state of nature and may appear to some to be the most wretched upon the earth, but in reality they are far happier than we Europeans." That was a very revealing comment from the person who discovered Australia, I thought.
Yes, well, actually, the comment about the convicts also made me think that one of the things that horrified Aboriginal people was the way in which convicts were treated, chained up and whipped. And I guess from a cross-cultural perspective, they were quite horrified by European cultural practices. They would have seen sort of as barbaric as perhaps some of the, and strange as Aboriginal practices might have been to other people.
And it should be said also that the first fleeters might not have survived if it hadn't been for the Aboriginal people who helped them with food and helped them get through those first tough 10, 20 years of settlement.
Well, that's right, absolutely.
We'd better head back to the phones because I've got a full board here, so let's have a chat to Norman. G'day, Norman.
Hi, I'd like to, the term, or you can't be Aboriginal because you're white. I just take the rugby league Indigenous side. When there's a white red-headed person playing for the Indigenous team, I'd just like to know by your guess, is there a percentage of Aboriginal blood that be called Aboriginal?
There is a test around Aboriginality that means that you just can't, wake up one morning and think, "Yep, I'd like to be Aboriginal." It's a much more complicated test than just simply how much percentage of blood you have in you. You do have to have Aboriginal ancestry, but you also have to identify. So, and then you also have to be accepted by the Aboriginal community as being Aboriginal. That's sort of the formal test that people have. So you'll find some people might say, well, I've got a mixed ancestry and I've got, a great-grandmother who was Aboriginal, but they themselves don't feel like that's the central part of their identity or who they are. And there are probably other people like me whose father was Aboriginal, and I've got fairly light skin myself, I've got to say. My brother's much darker than me, but I've grown up in the Aboriginal community, so it's really shaped who I am and my perspective on things. So I think it's a really good question, because one thing you can see when you see something like the Aboriginal football teams that come up is there's a great variety of Aboriginality that's out there, and particularly in Tasmania and in Victoria as well, the populations tended to have much more light skin than in the north, because you can imagine the climates were much different, the exposure to the sun over time, the skin level of pigmentation would just be different over, thousands of years of people living there. So it's meant that there's an enormous diversity in Aboriginal populations today.
There's a story in the book about a fellow who was quite white-skinned, but obviously descended from Aborigines, and he couldn't get acknowledged either in the Aboriginal community or in the white community. He was stuck in this sort of no-man's land in between. Let's have a chat to James. Hi, James.
How are you?
Hi, good. What do you want to say?
Oh, well, I'm married to an Aboriginal person.
Yep.
And I travelled all New South Wales when I was younger, and I found Aboriginal people very, very knowledgeable. I learned a lot from them.
Yep.
And when I first met my wife, I wasn't really accepted by her parents.
Okay. And how, and then did it get better, or did you start to get acceptance?
They didn't tell for a wedding, but she did marry me.
Right. So you gave you some insight into the culture. I mean, there was a lot of mixed marriages, a lot of half Aboriginal, half white person. I mean, the interaction between the sexes it went right back to the start, Larissa.
Yes, absolutely. And that's, I mean, that's a really important part of the story too, Michael, is that, you know, sometimes it's sort of portrayed as a bit of an us and them between black and white Australia, and it really does hide the fact that most Aboriginal families, you know, have a lot of mixed heritage in them, my own included, and I think it's impossible to find somebody who couldn't say that they had quite a lot of intermarriage into their communities. It's just the profile of who we are. And so within that, you know, when we talk about all the issues of discrimination and exclusion, in that most intimate part of our lives, in our families, you actually see this amazing sort of level of, I guess what you could call reconciliation, where black and white people do live together. And I think that's sort of an important part of the story that I think it was Norman was saying was about the fact that, you know, on that very personal level in people's lives, that sort of us and them that tends to be portrayed when we talk about the big issues.
We've got the news coming up, Larissa, so we've got to wind it up, unfortunately. I've still got so many calls and so many questions. We might have to get you back on, I think.
Oh, I'd love to.
Thanks for your time this morning.